It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Chances are you've heard of Massey Energy. At one time, it was the fourth largest producer of coal in the United States and the largest coal producer in Central Appalachia, with substantial operations in West Virginia, Kentucky, and Virginia. But most people know Massey Energy as the company that owned and operated the Upper Big Branch mine, where 29 miners were killed in April of 2010. The Mine Safety and Health Administration found the company's culture of favoring production over safety contributed to flagrant violations that caused the coal dust explosion. It's the company culture at Massey Energy that has become the basis for a new book by New York Times bestselling author Lawrence Lamer called The Price of Justice: A True Story of Greed and Corruption. He joins me in Studio A. Lawrence Lamer, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul.
If you would like to join the conversation, call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. You can email a question or comment to us at esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can always reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Lawrence Lamer, how did you become interested in the story of Massey Energy?
Well, when I was a young man, I went down to West Virginia and worked in a coal mine for a few months and wrote about it for Harper's Magazine. So I had a great feeling for that part of the world and for the coal miner and for that culture. And 40 years later, I read a story in the New York Times about how Hugh Caperton, who owned a small coal mine in Virginia, how in 1997, Massey Energy bought the subsidiary that purchased all of Hugh Caperton's coal. And Don Blankenship, who's the CEO of Massey Energy, looked at it and thought he was spending too much money for that coal. And he used these false measures to say he wasn't going to buy that coal anymore and drove Caperton into bankruptcy. And Caperton sued and won a $50 million judgment in the West Virginia court. It reached the Supreme Court of West Virginia. It turned the judgment back. It reached the United States Supreme Court, where Ted Olson, the famous appellate lawyer, argued the case, and the Supreme Court said that Blankenship had spent $3 million electing one justice who would vote his way. So the court said, you can't do that. John Grisham had written a novel about it based on part of that, so I thought, what a story this would be. I went down to West Virginia, I met with Caperton, and then I came here to Pittsburgh, and I met Dave Fawcett and Bruce Stanley, who are the heroes of my book, who for 14 years have been fighting Blankenship.
And you've actually, as you said, worked in a coal mine. How did that experience inform your telling of this story? What did you learn from being down in the mine?
Well, I have great admiration for coal miners. Over 100,000 miners have died in those mines. More have died in those mines than in Korea and Vietnam. And there's no monument to the miners on the mall in Washington, D.C., I tell you that. They're kind of ignored. And now that coal is going down and we know the environmental damage that coal caused, the coal miners and their culture are really kind of despised by the American intellectual elite. And I don't feel that way. I admire them, and I think what Blankenship did to them and the immense harm he did and that Dave Fawcett and Bruce Stanley brought out in the many cases in which they fought Blankenship and stood for justice. You can't have justice just in Pennsylvania if you don't have it in West Virginia. We didn't have justice there. When Caperton was decided by the West Virginia Supreme Court, when Dave Fawcett argued that case, he got up and was arguing their side. Skip Maynard, one of the five justices, got up, walked out, didn't even hear him, and didn't come back until it was finished. The next day, the justices voted they voted in 1 minute. They turned the case down in 1 minute. How do I know? Because Justice Larry Starcher gave me his personal diary.
The miners have always, it's certainly a tough life, and miners have always gotten a raw deal, it seems, when it comes to coal mining. The barons, the owners of the companies that run these mines, they make the big money. It's the coal miners who go down and risk their lives in the dark and end up with black lung and that kind of thing. Talk about the culture. Talk about how tough that job is. I don't think anybody that hasn't been down in those mines really understands what it's like down there.
Well, when I was working there 40 years ago, it was a little bit different because when you went down, there was no safety training. Now there's a week of safety training. And look, what's your choice? You got best of high school education. 40 years ago, it was either go to Detroit and work on the assembly line or work as a coal miner. I liked, in a way, I liked the mining because there were nine of us that worked in this mining crew. The boss kind of couldn't push us around very much. That we were proud in what we did. And after I worked the hoot owl shift from midnight to 8 a.m., and we came out of there in the morning, maybe there were 150 carloads of coal that we had mined, and we were proud of doing that.
But at the same time, it's very dark down there, darker than people realize, so not the easiest place to work, and it's dangerous.
It is, but these men, and then there are a few women, but of course it's almost overwhelmingly men, they are proud of what they do. They really are.
Sure, and well, they should be because it takes a brave person to go down there and do this. Is it safe to say that the Upper Big Branch mine disaster was not the start of Massey Energy's problems, but the culmination of them?
Yeah, well, 4 years before the Aracoma mine, there was a fire in the Aracoma mine, and two miners died in that fire. And Bruce Stanley took the case of these two widows. And the book, In the Price of Justice, is the trial. We go through the entire trial. And it was just devastating what Stanley was able to do during that week-long trial and expose that. Basically, it's evil to expose the lack of concern for safety that Blankenship had. The bottom line, that's all that matters. They lied about there were safety drills that they were supposed to have. They faked that. The ventilation
system. What do you mean when you say they faked that?
They would fill out the book that the miners had gone out and had these safety drills when they didn't have them. They faked it that they didn't.
They wrote that the drills were done, but they weren't actually ever undertaken.
Exactly. And these guys, look, Blankenship broke the union, basically. And there was one man, that Johnny Brown, that was gave testimony. He had worked 6 weeks straight, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, often in water, up to his hips sometimes, up to his hips or up to his waist. And now in the old days, the union, those guys would have been out of there. They wouldn't have put up with that, but they have to put up with that. But in any event, Stanley exposed this in a brilliant way during that trial. The government, there should have been criminal indictments for that. There weren't. Blankenship, the bottom line, all that matters, he paid about $3 million in fines. That he didn't care about that he'd pay the fines. And part of the settlement was there would be no criminal indictments against any of the management, against anybody. And so 4 years later, when the Upper Big Branch blew up and 29 miners died, it was the same stuff. It was exactly the same thing that happened. And Stanley basically had set it up in a way that now it couldn't be denied. And that is the primary reason that Blankenship was forced into retirement and Massey was sold to Alpha, which now runs those mines.
Describe the culture of corruption that developed and how it developed over the years. How Blankenship was able to get away with the violations he got away with and influence the judiciary.
Well, that's the coal country way. The coal power, totally dominant. They control it. Anybody who speaks out gets in trouble. You can't tell the truth. When do politicians tell the truth about what's going on? When they're leaving. Senator Robert Byrd spoke truthfully about the coal industry just a couple of weeks before he died. When Jay Rockefeller got up a few months ago on the floor of the Senate and talked about how there had to be a future beyond coal and how we had to deal with these environmental issues, I knew he was retiring because as soon as he said that, he would have been defeated if he'd run again.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Lawrence Lamer, author of The Price of Justice, A True Story of Greed and Corruption, here on 90.5 WESA. Why, Larry, is there so much corruption here? How were so many things able to go unchecked?
Because that is the way. That is the way of this, the tragedy of this community, of this state.
The state of West Virginia.
The state of West Virginia. That's for so long, this is what it has been. The West Virginia Supreme Court was corrupted. Either two of these, three of these justices. Listen, Spike Maynard, when this Caperton case was coming to the Supreme Court in Charleston, Maynard was off in southern France with Blankenship and their mistresses. And when this was discovered, the photos surfaced, Maynard had to recuse himself. The level of corruption and coercion and that is almost unheard of. That's why this book doesn't read. It's hard to believe that it's nonfiction, and it's hard to believe that it's the 21st century we're talking about. This is something you thought might have happened in the beginning, first years of the 20th century, not now.
The coal unions, as you mentioned, have traditionally or had in the past protected the miners and their interests. How did Blankenship break the union? What tactics did he employ?
Well, Blankenship is a poor boy. He's a poor boy from West Virginia. And when he was growing up, he worked in a coal mine. He was one year he took off from college. He needed the money. He's very admirable qualities. He was a union miner. So he knew what motivated miners. And in the 1984-85 strike, where the young Blankenship was the head of a subsidiary that was at the center of the strike, he knew what would push these guys to violence. And Elliot Maynard, that we've talked about, who later is on the West Virginia Supreme Court and was his close friend, Maynard made these rulings that the miners, they couldn't have marches, they couldn't have demonstrations. How were they to protest? And tragically, a few of them turned to violence, and one person was killed, and the union has settled. And that was the beginning of the end for this union. That when I worked in that mine, I thought it was so militant and strong, I thought it would last forever. Now it's primarily for retirees and the disabled.
After the disaster happened, what recourse did the family of these miners have?
Well, it depended. Massey's very shrewd, and the PR operations are very shrewd, and they got most of them to settle for what were relatively small amounts. Bruce Stanley took on the mother and the siblings of a miner that died. He was the only lawyer practicing in West Virginia that did this, and it was unheard of to get a settlement for those kinds of relatives, not just the immediate family and the kids. And he got a big settlement. We don't know what's confidential, but he got it. And they all could have gotten it if they'd had a lawyer like Bruce.
Your book details the corruption of the Supreme Court of West Virginia. Did the justices know that your book was coming down the pike?
Well, the justices are pretty darn upset now. I have my intimate sources about them. They're extremely upset. And they're also upset because they three times turned down this case. They sent it back. They sent back this then $70 million judgment in the lower trial. The third time, Dave Fawcett and Bruce Stanley took it to Virginia. The circuit court judge there turned it back, and they took it to the Virginia Supreme Court. And I thought, this is a conservative court. No, they're just going to turn this down and it's all over. But a few weeks ago, in an amazing unanimous verdict, the Supreme Court of Virginia said that this can go back to trial. In this 27-page opinion, it is a devastating critique of the West Virginia Supreme Court and how wrong it was and how egregious his opinions were.
The book is The Price of Justice, A True Story of Greed and Corruption. My guest has been the author, Lawrence Lamer. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us to tell this story, which we'll continue to tell here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul.
And up next, we'll talk with the heroes of this book, the attorneys Dave Fawcett and Bruce Stanley, about their efforts to try the case against Massey Energy. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In our first segment, we heard from best-selling author Lawrence Lamer about his new book, The Price of Justice, A True Story of Greed and Corruption, which tells the story of Massey Energy, owners of the Big Branch Mine, where 29 miners were killed in an explosion 3 years ago. I'm joined now by the heroes from this book, Pittsburgh attorneys Dave Fawcett and Bruce Stanley. For the past 15 years, they have been fighting what has been described as a two-person war against Don Blankenship, the chairman of Massey Energy, until its demise as the largest coal company in Appalachia. Dave Fawcett, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Bruce Stanley, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
And if you have questions or comments for our guests, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is essspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. It would be wonderful to hear from somebody in coal country, perhaps someone who has had experience working in the mines, and even for this particular company. Dave Fawcett and Bruce Stanley, what led you to get involved in the legal battle with Massey Energy?
Well, I got involved from the start, Paul, and Hugh Caperton had come to me because his company had been put out of business by some ruthless conduct, and it was sort of right up my alley. I do business disputes and commercial litigation. So the problem was he couldn't pay for the litigation, and so me and my firm at the time, Buchanan Ingersoll, agreed to take it on a contingent fee basis, meaning we would recover if he recovered in the end of the case. So that's how I originally took the case on, and then it was probably 2 years into it that I brought in my friend Bruce Stanley, who had worked with me at the firm for a while, then joined Reed Smith, and so the two of us took on the case.
Describe what the odds of you being in any way successful were back when you first started.
If I may,
sure. Go ahead, Dave.
The odds were great at the beginning, and we and Bruce and I worked really well together with a lot of other people, other lawyers and paralegals and so on. And we tried what we thought was a great case and got a big verdict. We thought the odds were very good that that verdict would stick, and we thought it was a proper case and well tried. 2 month trial back in 2002. It was only after that trial that Don Blankenship, who was appalled by the verdict, the size of the verdict, and said it was bad for the children of West Virginia. There was a judicial election for the Supreme Court of West Virginia. He created a committee called For the Sake of the Kids, in which he contributed $3.5 million. That money then went to pay for what is known in political parlance as hit ads, and he knocked off, figuratively speaking, a sitting Supreme Court justice on the West Virginia Supreme Court and had elected a relatively unknown Republican judge, first Republican in West Virginia to be elected to the Supreme Court since 1924. So that judge then, at the time, of course, we thought, well, with all these campaign contributions from Massey and Blankenship, that he would step aside and should properly step aside. We asked and asked and asked for that to happen, and he refused. And then ultimately, he cast a deciding vote to dismiss the case, to reverse it and dismiss it.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, you wanted to chime in.
Well, I was just going to say, and that's ultimately how we ended up in front of the Supreme Court of the United States. Fascinating part of this case, I think Lawrence Lamer mentioned it before, is when the photos came out. Justice Spike Maynard, I had known – I'm from Mingo County. I was born in the same county as these two gentlemen. I had known them, had some idea of them. I had some idea about Spike. I had no idea, though, that Spike would engage in the type of conduct that ultimately came out during the course of our appeal. That's when the photograph showing him and Don Blankenship vacationing in Monaco appeared. And initially, even after those photographs appeared, I thought it was fascinating that Spike said, "I'm not stepping down. I can decide this case fairly." And it was only through the intense media pressure that was brought to bear that he realized if he had any hope of remaining in public life, he needed to do the right thing and get off the case. But Brent Benjamin refused all the way through to the Supreme Court of the United States. So what we thought was, and I would point out too, it wasn't just us who said that the verdict was a justified, well-founded verdict. All five sitting justices of the Supreme Court of West Virginia, when that first bill came out, said and agreed this is a justified verdict, and chose instead over legal technicality and minutia that occupied 76 pages of opinion to say, but we're going to throw the verdict out. And as the book details, presumably from then Justice Larry Starcher's diary, that 76-page opinion occupied approximately 1 minute of discussion time and deliberations in the Supreme Court.
And as you mentioned, your legal battles with Massey began with a case that made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. What came out of that?
Well, the issue that the issue that was presented to the Supreme Court was whether a person in a lawsuit has the right, the constitutional right, to demand a judge to step aside in certain situations. And that was the case that Bruce and I argued with, along with Ted Olson, who we asked to join us and did join us for that argument. And the Supreme Court found that, yes, in this situation, Hugh Caperton and Harmon Monning had the constitutional right as a matter of due process of law to demand that Justice Benjamin not decide this case, even though Justice Benjamin insisted that he could be fair.
And you had referred earlier, Dave, to a hit ad that was a tactic that was used in manipulating the judiciary. Just describe what you meant by that.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating part of the story. And, of course, it's really well captured by Larry Lamer in his book. And really, it's the story that we see over and over in politics today. Somebody with a lot of money ran political hit ads. This is the 30-second ads that that painted the sitting justice as a very, very bad person and made him look horrible. So and the papers at the time, the newspapers, were indicating, well, Blankenship was funding this campaign. But one thing we learned was that people really are watching television around election time, and TV trumps newspapers, in essence. And so people were going to the polls saying, gosh, I'm not going to vote for this guy. He seems like, he was a child rapist. That the issue related to a decision to let out a fellow from prison. And Larry, again, details it all in his book. But that's the way it was done.
And that's the Tony Arbaugh story. Tony was a young man who was raised in a troubled household, had enormous issues growing up, and found himself and on the wrong side of the law at a very early age. Chief Justice Robin Davis, though she disagreed with the opinion, which was to give the young man another chance rather than put him in, I think it was a 15-year jail term, hard time, as a minor. The majority said, let's give this young man another chance. She said no. And that opinion, where they said, let's give that young man another chance, was what was used as the basis of the attack ads on the sitting justice at that time, Warren McGraw.
So you have Blankenship behind the scenes orchestrating all of this. We've discussed the hubris of power on this program. Would you characterize Don Blankenship as a man with a great deal of hubris, Dave?
You know, the way I've always described it is that Massey, under Blankenship's direction, was really everything that's wrong with corporate America today, at least those corporations that did like he did, which is essentially look at the world and make all decisions based upon a cost-benefit analysis, you know, what makes most sense monetarily. So I argued to juries in several cases that, you know, they could not allow that to happen. You know, you can't break a contract or fail to adhere to safety regulations just because in the end it might be more cost-effective to take that tact. That's why we have laws. That's why we have safety laws and contracts and so on. So, you know, that's the way I look at him, as a man that saw his job to make as much money as possible for the for his corporation, for his shareholders, and really doing that in a manner of just exclusively looking at dollars and cents rather than bigger overriding issues.
And to add to that, Larry was talking about the Arakoma mine fire. Don Blankenship was communicating into that mine directly by facsimile, email, directly into that mine, asking questions about why a certain section or shift wasn't working when, you know, that mine was in deplorable condition. And that's the famous stay on coal, just run coal memo, and the running coal attitude. I don't care what any of your vice presidents, mine superintendents, anyone else has told you, whether you're talking about, frankly, safety construction projects or other things that need to be done, you're to ignore them and just run coal. That's the attitude that dominated that company. If I could tell the dad's story.
Yeah, quickly. This is a great story. Go ahead.
Don, there was a story, and I asked Don Blankenship about this in a deposition, and he confirmed it to be true, that and sometimes when a middle manager or someone new would start at Massey, they'd come to their desk, and if one of the first things they'd find is a coffee mug sitting on their desk that had the dad's root beer logo on it, and you know, they'd be curious and say, well, that's interesting. What's it for? And they say, well, don't you get it? Dad's, D-A-D-S, do as Don says. And Don Blankenship was a micromanager who, as CEO, put his fingertips down into the deepest reaches of those mines in order to extract coal at the safety and expense at the safety and, frankly, the lives of his miners.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. My guests are Pittsburgh attorneys Bruce Stanley, whom you just heard, and Dave Fawcett. They have been fighting what has been described as a two-person war against the aforementioned Don Blankenship, the chairman of Massey Energy, until its demise as the largest coal company in Appalachia. Describe what this ordeal has been like, gentlemen, for the families you represent.
Well, I mean, I had the privilege of representing Dolores Bragg and Frieda Hatfield, the widows in the Arakoma mine case. And it was amazing to me the fungible nature in which the way Massey looked at these surviving widows, that there was almost a sense of anger at from Don and his underlings.
The owner of the company.
Yes.
Whose questionable practices might well have led or in
We sued him personally. Our goal was to hold him personally accountable for the condition of that mine because it got in that condition because of his direct intervention.
And these are the survivors of the people that died in the mine, and he is looking at them disparagingly.
Absolutely. I remember he came to his deposition driving his Bentley and refused to even acknowledge their presence there. And took umbrage almost at the fact that, you know, almost a how dare you attitude. Take your insurance settlements, take your pension fund monies, and take your benefits packages and go away.
This the cases, and in particular the one that did go to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, really that case ended up being just the tip of the iceberg, apparently, Dave.
It was, and another part of this story here is a story that I'm proud of. I'm proud of our work, but there were times after the verdict was reversed and we were thrown out of court that we were really hanging by a string, and Bruce and I used to laugh, how thin was that string? And there were times where it was, you know, thin as a thread or spider's silk. But in every case, when we were sort of down, almost down and out, somebody spoke up. And, you know, the problem with West Virginia, they should have been protesting, I'd say, like the lawyers in Pakistan had. You know, they should have been talking. And we used to get calls, hey, I know this, I know that, but people wouldn't say things out loud. But in the end, there at these critical junctures, the media came in, whether it was a journalist or a newspaper writer, and really did a story or brought something to light that then led people to come forward with evidence. In fact, that's the way we had been kicked out of court twice, and Bruce had filed a motion for recusal relative to Justice Maynard. And it was only after that one evening we had delivered anonymously photographs of a vacation that we had heard of and had been rumored, but I started telling people, stop telling me about this unless you have evidence. And someone did, in fact, produce photographs.
This was the vacation that Blankenship took to France.
Yes.
Yep.
And in the end, I feel that there is a sense in this state that people, a greater sense that they can speak up and not be beaten down for it. And I think there's a sense that journalists and writers can write about these things, although it's not without courage and without a fight, for sure. Yeah.
There was a federal investigation into Upper Big Branch where the explosion killed 29 miners 3 years ago. What came out of that investigation?
Oh, it's ongoing. That grand jury is still sitting. It's still taking evidence. Thus far, I think there have been a total of 3 indictments. But it's wider.
As I understand it, four.
Okay,
former
four.
Massey executives were successfully prosecuted.
Have pled guilty, and the most significant of those was a man named Hugert, who was admitted to having tipped off underground miners about federal inspectors coming on site to conduct safety inspections and halting operations in order to try to get things fixed up before the inspector could make it underground to their location. Oftentimes, these the mine inspectors have to travel miles underground to get to the working face to see what's actually going on underground, and a tip-off will allow an underground foreman time to get it cleaned up. And so Huger admitted that he was involved and carried out that activity. Most fascinating thing about that aspect of it was when at his allocution in front of Judge Irene Berger in the Southern District of West Virginia, she asked him, you know, did you basically conspire with anyone else to do this work? And he said yes, and she said who? And he said the CEO. Now, there was a quick bitch conference associated with that, but out on the sidewalk later, it was made clear by Huger's wife. When you say when your husband talked about the CEO, who was he referring to? And she said, "Oh, Don Blankenship. He called our house regularly. We lived in fear."
So, and we've got just a little over a minute left. Could Blankenship be next, the next person to be prosecuted?
Well, there's certainly that chance. But who knows? I mean, prosecutorial discretion being what it is, and the burden that a criminal conviction to obtain a criminal conviction is so overwhelming, they won't indict unless they have what they believe is a solid case, I would think.
But we're hopeful that they certainly follow the evidence to where it leads, as they say. And, you know, the situation of the vacation in Monaco, truly that's something that should have been pursued to the end and more questions asked than were. Is the kind of thing that shouldn't be tolerated, you know, just like a civil society can't tolerate a CEO contributing millions of dollars to a judge who then stays on a case.
We've been talking with attorneys Dave Fawcett and Bruce Stanley, and I want to thank both of you gentlemen for taking the time to join us on Essential Pittsburgh, and good luck with your pursuit of justice.
Well, thank you, Paul.
Glad to be here.
Coming up, business correspondent Rebecca Harris has part two of her series on business basics as Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.